Good morning and welcome to the SPICE seminar on climate change, science, policy and solutions on a global scale. We have very esteemed guests with us this morning and it's the topic of the moment, really. In fact, not really, it definitely is. And certainly this week in the Scottish Parliament has been a big week for discussing the issues around climate change. I'm Gillian Martin. I am the convener of the Environment, Climate Change and Land Reform Committee. And of course, yesterday, you'll all know, we had our stage one debate in the chamber. We also hosted, you hopefully have seen in the media, we also hosted some of our agents of change, the young climate strikers, in our committee yesterday. We're very proud that we did that. So we're responding to what's going out there in Civic Scotland at a youth level. I'll just introduce our speakers first of all. So going from my right to left, we have Thelma Krug from IPCC, and then we have Jim Ski from the IPCC, and then we have Yuba Sakona. They have, of course, been in Edinburgh this week working with other colleagues on their next piece of work. They are going to be talking for about 10 minutes each on the forthcoming assessment cycle, how the IPCC connects to policy and what the working group plan to do at their time in Edinburgh and in the future. Initially, though, I'd like to move on to briefly just outline the recent work that we've been doing in the committee. Throughout October and November last year, we scrutinised the Climate Change Bill, which proposes to increase Scotland's 2050 greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets from 80 to 90%. And we concluded the stage one scrutiny yesterday, as I've said. We noticed that several significant issues need to be addressed, and provisions strengthened to ensure that Scotland fully contributes to meeting the challenge of limiting temperature rises to 1.5, as set out by the IPCC report, which was published, I think, around October, November. It was October. I was just saying to Yuba, at the time where the IPCC report was published, myself and Mark Ruskell were at the Arctic Circle conference, where it was effectively the talk of the steamy happened. Right at the moment where that conference and lots of discussions about what they said actually meant for all the countries that were represented there. So in our report, just a brief overview, some of the key points in our report which we put forward for stage one was that we wanted to really highlight the intergenerational justice issue around climate change. And I guess as a country that has benefited from, you know, mass industrialization, a developed country like Scotland, what our responsibility is, not just to future generations, but to the rest of the world when tackling the effects of that industry and that lifestyle that we've had for, you know, I guess nigh on a century, more than a century now. And we also mentioned that transformational change is fundamental to achieving a secure and fair future for the planet, and the speed and scale of the changes needed in emissions reductions, pathways and changes to social and technical systems had no precedent in human history. And of course, that was highlighted in the middle of our scrutiny when the report was issued. We actually were halfway through taking our evidence by the time the IPCC reports. But it was factored in our heads. We weren't going to just say, well, that report hasn't come out, we're not going to take evidence on it. We absolutely had that at the forefront of our minds when we wrote our report to the government. And the committee noted throughout the report that we'd like to see a greater urgency of action across all parts of government and across wider private sectors and by individuals. And I think one of the more significant things in our report was that call for cross-portfolio action in the government. It's not something that could be looked at just from the portfolio of Rosanna Cunningham. It has to go into the portfolios of other cabinet secretaries, and it has to be something that's rolled out, or else we're not going to do it. So enough from me. You'll all know what the committee is doing. Just a little bit of an introduction. I'd like to pass over to Yuba Sakona. to talk to you about the work that's been done by the IPCC.
Okay, good morning. It's my pleasure to be here for the first time in Edinburgh, in Scotland. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to take part in this conversation. And IPCC is changing. As you know, we change every 6-7 years, but for the best and for the better, not like climate changing. And then as evidence, we have Jim Ski, a Scottish man who is one of the co-chair. And then he took over what I was the co-chair for the FIFA assessment report. This is for the better. And, you know, during this cycle, we have been very ambitious because of the magnitude of the problem we are facing. And for the first time forever, IPCC embarked on 3 special reports. That's never happened before. And for the first time in the life of IPCC, and then the 3 working group take the responsibility of leading the report. And that also is unique. This is the first time for the life of IPCC. And then on those 3 special reports, we look at the air, land, and ocean. And then those were critical elements, and then to look at, try to explore, because we are not doing research, and then we rely on the published literature. And then to look at where are we currently, and then from the literature, where do we want to go, and how to get there. And then the first report was on 1.5. Because in the beginning, when we had been asked to do it, we all said that, oh, there's no way you can do that, because there is no publication, there is no literature, and then just forget about it. We even get surprised to get the result we find in the 1.5 report, and then that was the joint 3 working groups for the first time they do together. That means integration of everything, not mitigation apart, adaptation apart, climate science apart. And then that was released last October. And then the second special report is land. Land issues, land degradation, desertification, and other. And then to the same narrative, and then to do where are we in terms of understanding the issues, various implications related to food, agriculture, and other aspects. And then that was also a joint effort of the 3 working group together. And then that will be released, we expect, next August. And the third one is on ocean and cryosphere. And then that was also a joint effort of working group 2 and 3, and then that will be released presumably in September. And for that, we will have also the refinement of methodology, because the IPCC invented at national level. Thelma was the co-chair of this task force during the previous assessment, and then to refine it and then to make it much more related to the current situations, and then that will be released next May in Japan. And we had received a lot of requests for special report. One of the critical issue also to deal with was the city as cities, human settlements. And then we said that it's impossible. We cannot do more than 3 special reports, and then even that was a bit challenging. But we embark on to give a special attention within the 3 working groups assessment to the city issue, and then we organize a science a conference on cities in Edmonton in Canada, and then that to prepare for a special report in the cycle of 7 assessment cycle. And apart from that, we look at some of the critical elements in terms of try to better understand the issue of, to organize some expert meeting on short-lived climate pollutant. And this is also a very critical fundamental aspect, what we know and then how to have a clarity, and then that will feed also the 6 assessment report process. And then we also had an expert meeting on assessing climate for information for regional because we need to also bring the regional aspect in the main assessment. Apart from that, we have our classical assessment of the three chapters on the climate science, on impact, adaptation, and vulnerability, and then on mitigation. I will not go to details, and if you go to detail, Jim will tell you that it's not exactly what was done in the FIFA assessment report. We bring a very different element, and then that will respond to inform some of the decisions that need to be taken at certain level. This is very important. Apart from that, we also invest a lot on communication and outreach, and then to train the authors, and then to train the all the IPCC, those who have responsibility in how to communicate, better communicate, because our jargon, and then so that it will be attracted by your audience. You know, on the 1.5, it was complex and complicated, and then we resume it in three statements, and even a kindergarten can understand that. And then every bit of warming counts, every action counts, and then every second counts. You know, those are some simplicity of different messages in order to be able to communicate. And then we have also, you know, I think that we said that the tweet of the 1.5 was 4.3 million of tweet of the 1.5. And then we made a lot, and then we have on the intensive outreach, and then to have also working with, you know, our mandate is to do the assessment, and then we are not making any recommendation, we are not making any suggestion, but we work with number of different other organizations, institutions. They can have some derivative product of the IPCC, and then to better communicate some of the key findings, and then we work on that. In terms also of the structure of those who are doing the work, and then initially it was highly dominated by scientists from the north, and then in this last country. And then we also look at that different aspect. And then if we look at the number of scientists from developing country and emission transition economy, and then industrialized country is 44% and 56%. In the previous assessment, that was 37%. We look at the gender balance. It's very important. And then we try to have half-half of the expert. And then we made a lot of progress. Actually, the female are 33%, and then the male are 67%. In the previous assessment, it was 21%. And then we are making also some progress. In the previous assessment, it was only during the fourth assessment report we have a female as a co-chair of a working group. And then we also made some changes at that level. And then we are making also some progress on this front. And then the important element will be also the synthesis report, and then that is due to 2022 in order to better inform the global stocktake of UNFCCC, the Climate Convention, on 2023. And then those are some of the highlight of some of the things, changes that is happening in the IPCC. It's important that also that to make an emphasis, and then the working group are not at all working now in the silos. There is more integration that is very important, and then to notice. It's also important that to notice also we are bringing in the process the Earth Carrier scientists. And then we give an emphasis on chapter scientists. This is also, they are higher at international level, and then to support the authors at the same time to be prepared to take over when we will stop dealing with that to go for fishing. Because for to take some calm and then to give to them the responsibility to continue the assessment. And those are some of the elements I just want to highlight in order to kickstart the conversation. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for giving us that that starter assessment of an overview of the work that's been done. I'm going to move on to asking and using a little bit of my leftover Portuguese, say bom dia to Thelma Krug. Thelma is the director of the Department of Policies to Combat Deforestation in the Ministry of the Environment in Brazil. Thelma.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, good morning to all. It's really exciting to be here. It was more exciting to see Monday and Tuesday with an excellent weather. So now it's back, you know, into the normal Scottish weather, so it is fine. Unlike you, Bob, I have been here before in a completely different situation. I was a PhD student at Sheffield University in England, and there was this students' meeting at the University of Edinburgh when I came to present my then ongoing work, which was on spatial statistics. So that's my background. So mathematics is like a discipline that goes across anything, right? So including, obviously, climate change. So, but I would like to talk a little bit on this interface between science and policy, and also the relevance of the IPCC work in terms of its policy relevance. So I normally say that, you know, IPCC is the real example of success, as I say, bridging science and policymakers. And the reason of this is, obviously, IPCC is an intergovernmental panel on climate change. So essentially, you have policymakers talking to scientists. This is not something very easy. How does it work? I think it works because, in essence, and it's improving, we are now in the sixth cycle of the IPCC, and I see that it systematically improves the relation that I see between scientists and governments. Why do I say that? Because, for instance, when the IPCC panel decides to carry out some type of report or even the assessment, we start with the scoping meeting. And the scoping is done by scientists. So, in essence, policymakers are saying in the panel of the IPCC that they would like to see how scientists see that work being carried out. So what elements they see could be included with their background on the science, existing science globally. That was really a challenge when we started to do the 1.5 special report. Was there enough science that could, you know, be used? You know, to would there be sufficient science for 1.5 in terms of assessing the impacts and put in pathways to reach that 1.5 global warming by the end of the century? So it starts like that. So scientists are challenged to put together, you know, bullet points, chapters, an outline that is then brought to the panel. And then the panel sees if the scientists will deliver what from the policy point of view would be what they would be expecting. So there is this interchange between policy and scientists, and policymakers saying, can you deliver that? Because that's what they need for their policy decisions. So that talk, you know, that starts in governments being engaged in reviewing the draft of the reports and having the opportunity to identify also potential gaps in the literature that has been assessed. So governments have a go. And that is what makes it absolutely relevant. And at the end of the process, when we come to the approval session of the summary for policymakers, which is a synthetic part of the report, which tries to, in 20, 25 pages, synthesize, you know, hundreds of pages of the reports with the key messages that touch the hearts of the policymakers. And in that respect, in that session, it goes essentially, you know, paragraph by paragraph. So all governments have to be engaged on that. And then that takes a whole week you know, to have this approval session. And some people from outside would see this as a possible interference of governments into the work of the scientists. And this is not absolutely true, I would say. What I think is sometimes difficult is to level the language of the scientists in a way that policymakers can understand. And mind you, we are talking about governments that come from the developing world, from the developed world, and sometimes a paragraph that, you know, fits well to the developed world does not best so for the developing world. So that's quite a challenge, but this really makes it important to bridge the science with the policymakers. So I would say that one of the most relevant indicators of the policy relevance of the work of the IPCC is the use of the IPCC reports in the international climate negotiations. For instance, at the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Climate Change Convention. So that is, we say that our products, the main user of our products would be the Conference of the Parties to the Climate Change Convention. But not solely so. So the Conference of the Parties would use the IPCC reports as a baseline of the scientific knowledge on climate change when they are doing these science-based decisions. And they, if we look in the Paris Agreement, for instance, you know, the recent Paris Agreement, there are many references to science information. The most updated science. So at least four or five times you've seen the Paris Agreement referenced based on the best available science. And obviously these, to us it's very clear, it's the IPCC who is going to, you know, bringing the most updated information for the policymakers. If we look in the Paris Agreement, since Yuba was mentioning the methodological report, there is one part of the Paris Agreement that says that parties shall regularly provide information on emissions by sources and removals by sinks, like forests are sinks, using methodology accepted by the IPCC and agreed by the Conference of the Parties. So you see that not only the assessment reports with the scientific information is relevant to this process, but the methodological reports of the IPCC, one of which, as Yuba has said, is being refined and updated. We are going to go to this approval session now in acceptance session now in May in Japan, which brings updated information on how countries could report emissions that have not been contemplated before because there was no science to, available to provide the information to back up the methodology to be developed and used by all countries, I would say, in their national inventories. We also have to bear in mind that it's not very often, but for instance, the special report on 1.5 global warming was one invitation from the Conference of the Parties of the Climate Change Convention. So they were the ones who, with the Paris Agreement temperature, limiting the temperature increase, the global temperature increase, and pursuing the 1.5. The policymakers felt that there was not enough information on impacts, you know, of the 1.5. And also how could that limit of global warming be reached by the end of this century? What would be the potential pathways or trajectories in terms of emissions that would lead us to the 1.5? There is not a single way. There may be potentially different ways that would have different implications in the mitigation and adaptation portfolio that we are going to have to put together as globally. So so that invitation was brought to the IPCC for consideration. Basically, they are the same countries, governments in the policy forum, and then, you know, governments in the scientific realm, I would say. And so when IPCC accepted the invitation to do the 1.5 special report, it included some considerations which I think that's a really turning point for the IPCC, because it brought forward that this report on 1.5 should be developed in the context of sustainable development, eradication of poverty, so reducing inequalities, strengthening the global response to the threat of climate change. So it brought, you know, this report is going to be done. But mind you, we are bringing in all these elements together that, you know, bring additional consideration of social scientists being engaged in this work, because we are talking about sustainable development. We are bringing people to be the center focus, let's say, of what we are producing. So it's not only the physical elements, adaptation, mitigation, but you are also having, you know, the human being as the central focus, I would say, of this. So it was quite relevant. So if I would also see another potential, you know, how potentially the IPCC will continue to contribute to the Climate Change Convention, we have the Global Stock Take for the Paris Agreement. So every 5 years from 2023, we already had in the last COP the Talanoa Dialogue, when we presented to the subsidiary body on scientific technological advice. There was this joint meeting between the IPCC and SABSTA, presenting the findings, the main findings of the 1.5 special report. So already feeding into the Paris Agreement, and we see that since the first global stocktake is going to take place in 2023, the IPCC assessment reports will come just in time, you know, with the synthesis report coming up in 2022, and global stocktake in 2023. So we see that there will be a lot of scientific elements that might be very helpful when scientific decisions will need to be taken, you know, as part of the Paris involvement. And Jim, you didn't send me a note yet that I am expanding my time.
I was looking at you meaningfully.
That doesn't suffice. I told Jim, I got so enthusiastic, you know, about this, that I sometimes get carried over. So to finalize, I would also like to mention that we have the Climate Summit in September of this year. And so the Secretary General, Antonio Gutierrez, is bringing forward in the Climate Summit, you know, key messages that is taken from special reports, and the IPCC in particular is going to have a very special role into this because of the two special reports, the 1.5 and the Climate Change and Land Report that Yuba has mentioned. Unfortunately, the ocean is coming in September, possibly too late to have the key messages from oceans and cryosphere included into the key messages from the Climate Summit. But we do see an excellent opportunity for our key findings also to be brought to a general audience that includes not only governments, but the civil society, business people, private sector, and so on. So this is just, you know, just an overall picture of why we get so excited about this work. Because it's not a work only, you know, to be used by scientists. So we are reaching much more, you know, many more people outside the scientists, and this is really a good challenge for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Thelma. And now on to Jim Ski. You'll know Jim Ski's vice chair, but bringing it to the Parliament as well, of course, Jim gave evidence to us in our committee on the climate change report, and also recently appointed chair of Scotland's Just Transition Commission.
Yeah.
Easy for me to say. So I'll hand over to Jim.
Okay. Thanks, Gillian. And I'm going to talk specifically about the Working Group 3 report on mitigation and the plans for it in this cycle. And just to say, it's due out in July 2021, and there are four lead author meetings that need to take place before it's finalised. And the first one is taking place out at Pollock Halls at the moment. We have 180 authors from all over the world, from more than 60 countries there. So there is an intense amount of activity going on all this week. One point I want to flag is they're not starting from a blank sheet, because the scoping of the report, as Thelma's hinted, is quite intricate. It takes place in two stages. Almost 2 years ago, we had a week-long scoping meeting for the report with scientists in Addis Ababa, and they came out with a proposed outline for the report. But that's not the end of it. That outline then needs to go to a full plenary of IPCC to be discussed by the governments, who can pick over it so that they have bought into the outline of the report. And so the authors here are working to an outline which they now can't change in any way. They have to stick to that. And I can say that the process with the governments was quite an interesting one. We counted out it took 13 hours of negotiation time with the governments just to get the Working Group 3 outline covered. I think we are the most difficult one because we're probably closest to policy. And there were a couple of the usual suspect chapters that took a lot of time, energy and agriculture, forestry and land use. But the other one that actually caused the greatest amount of time was the one on investment and finance, including debates as to whether the word price was policy prescriptive. So this was an extremely interesting kind of process. So, however, when we ran that initial scientific scoping meeting, we did start with a blank sheet. We got the experts there, and we trusted on the facilitation process to come out with something. But myself and my fellow co-chair, Shukla, for Working Group 3, sort of set out three challenges that we wanted the report to address. And one of them was in response to a kind of pushback we'd had after the fifth assessment report, that it was too much focused on large global long-term issues and didn't connect sufficiently to the practical actions that people might take in the short to medium term. So we set that out as a challenge. I mean, sure, we need to think about the year 2100. We obviously need to think global, but we also need to think in more practical terms about what can be done to get us on the right path. The second one is that we wanted to pick up on a wider range of disciplines and kinds of knowledge that IPCC had not fully assessed in the past. And that was specifically in relation to the social sciences and to the questions of human behaviour, consumption, etc. So that was a challenge that we set out to the scoping meeting. And the final one was to try to connect climate change mitigation with other policy areas and other policy goals. And what we had specifically in mind there was the question of sustainable development and the sustainable development goals, which had been agreed before we got into the report. And that's nicely where you also have a link into the just transition idea as well, you know, pulling out that part of it. So these were the challenges that we set out to the people. Now, at the end of that process, the outline that we've got, it has certain continuities from the fifth assessment report, but it also has a number of innovations in it that I think are really well worth flagging. I'm not going to go through 17 chapters, don't worry, but I'll just flag up the innovative elements. One is that we really did try to nail sustainable development as a key framing concept. So the first chapter is intended to sort of frame the whole report and set up the way that sustainable development affects different areas of human activity. And our chapter 17, the final one, will draw the threads together and synthesize things in terms of the links between mitigation and sustainable development. Addressing this question about, you know, the global and the long term versus the more local and specific, we've actually divided the future up into two different time slices. So we've got one chapter that thinks all the way out to the year 2100, which is the home of the big modellers, effectively, and it's our link to Working Group 1 in the physical sciences. So that was very much like the chapter we had in AR5. But we've got a new chapter called Mitigation Pathways and Development Pathways in the Short to Medium Term, which is much more about the practical kind of actions, more the 2030 kind of time scale, covering the the pledges after Paris and the Sustainable Development Goals. And one of the things that the authors have been debating out at Pollock Halls is when the short to medium term stops and when the long term starts. That was deliberately left creatively ambiguous at the scoping stage to give us a little bit of flexibility. So that's one of the subjects that's out for discussion there. The other big one, we've got a completely new chapter on social aspects of mitigation. And this is a big challenge for IPCC because the outline and the detailed description contains words like culture, lifestyle, behaviour, which have been really, governments have been allergic to, I think, in past cycles. And it's going to be a bit of a challenge for us, I think, as we develop the chapter and take it through to the approval process. And the final one I'd like to mention isn't actually a chapter at all. It's an annex we've put there on scenarios and modelling methodology. Because one of the criticisms we had from AR5 was that the models that were used as black boxes and nobody understands what goes on in them. And I'm well aware from reading the committee's papers on the evidence for the climate change bill about the role of the Times model in Scotland. And so I believe you probably may have some sympathies with this idea of black boxes and what models can tell you and what models cannot tell you. The big integrated assessment models we are looking at are sort of, you know, times squared, if I can put it that way. So we have the same kind of challenge, but we really want to get this transparency issue out because the modellers are making some kind of implicit assumptions that actually have a lot of policy content and value to them as well. And we really need to make that much more transparent, I think, to make it useful to policymakers. Now, specifically on what we're doing outside, at Pollock Halls this week, IPCC is seen as a mysterious kind of organisation, you know, a cabal of scientists who get together and plot to send messages to the outside world. And in fact, we have a team of sociologists out there studying IPCC. They're interviewing authors and will produce their report at the end of the cycle once we've all done it. But obviously, two things we want from the author teams, and they're mostly meeting in separate chapter meetings across the 17 chapters. We want them to turn the bullet points that governments agreed to and turn them into a proper structure for each individual chapter so that you have a proper narrative running through each chapter, because the bullet points can be a bit haphazard by themselves. And sometimes, frankly, the authors struggle to figure out what the governments meant by their bullet points, but that's all good. The other thing that we need to do is to make sure that there is connection and a narrative across the whole report. So we're also operating in some cross-cutting breakout groups as well. And we had some yesterday, and just to give you an example of the kind of things we've been looking at, we have been looking at the role of scenarios across the chapters and the way in which they can sort of bring coherence across the messaging. We've had a big debate on the framing chapter, the chapter one, and how it sets up the different concepts and the different disciplines that are going to be assessed across the whole report. We had one on policies and institutions because we have a policies chapter and we're trying to figure out which policies should be covered at the sectoral level and which policies should be covered more generically. And in fact, we would like the policies and institutions chapter to look much more at the institutional developments that have taken place since the fifth assessment report. So things like the UK and Scottish Climate Change Act frameworks would actually make wonderful case studies. And it's my private ambition, which I shouldn't tell anybody, to get them a little bit used as case studies, in the report. And the last one we dealt with yesterday was the dreaded issue of agriculture, forestry, land use and bioenergy and where you locate it in the report. Because you well know bioenergy is often talked about in an energy context, but in the inventories, which Thelma knows all about, biomass and bioenergy is treated as part of the AFALU sector. And there's an interesting challenge about how to locate that. But that's as much as I'll probably say just to open it up. But as we say, the report is due out in July 2021, and we've got an awful lot of work to do before then. But we're really thankful for the Scottish Government, the University of Edinburgh, who are getting us launched. Thank you.